Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program are Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry at the program's controls this morning. Almost 15 years ago, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman set out to explore a territory that in scholarly terms, really hadn't been explored very much. And that was the psychological cost of killing in the line of duty. And the result was a book, On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society. Since this book was published first, it has become required reading in many police and military academies. The book has now been updated to examine the realities of 21st century warfare and also to look at the broad impact of killing and violence on our society. You can find it published by Back Bay Books, which is a division of Little Brown. It's out in the bookstores now if you'd like to look at it. And, of course, questions and comments are welcome here as we discuss both these subjects, that is, warfare and the impact of killing on society, with our guest, Dave Grossman. Let me tell you a little more about him. He's a former Army Ranger, paratrooper, and psychology professor at West Point. Since he retired from the Army in 1998, he's devoted himself to teaching, writing, and training military and law enforcement organizations worldwide about the reality of combat. And he's joining us this morning by a telephone. Questions are certainly welcome. We just ask people to keep their questions and comments brief and keep them on the topic. But otherwise, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have a toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Colonel Grossman, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate
it. You're so welcome. It's my pleasure.
To start, let me ask you two really basic questions. It may be to some people that it's obvious why this subject is important, but there I want to start. Why do you think that it is important to study this?
You know, David, this book, again, as you so kindly said up front, has been out for 15 years. It's required reading at peace studies programs at Berkeley and Mennonite and Quaker colleges where I've spoken in their peace studies programs. There's also Marine Corps Commandant's required reading and FBI Academy required reading. So people say, how do you make Berkeley and the Marine Corps, the FBI and the Quakers all have to read the same book? And the answer is you just tell the truth. At one level, we're all on the same side. We just want to understand what is happening to human beings and what we're doing to human beings. It is a taboo topic. As a young sergeant, 82nd Airborne Division, I had Vietnam veterans all around me. I was not a Vietnam veteran. I've missed most action there is to have. But I would ask the veterans, the young soldiers like me would ask the veterans, what's combat like? And they wouldn't say. It was this incredibly taboo topic. You can dig deep into the literature and find very little reflection on the actual act of killing, not murder, not homicide. Because, what our soldiers do in warfare, hopefully, is not necessarily homicide. It's socially sanctioned killing, and law enforcement, same thing. And so I began to research on this topic. And as a West Point psychology professor, as an Army Ranger, as an infantry company commander, writing a book on the topic, for the first time in their lives, people would talk. The Vietnam veterans would talk. The World War II veterans would talk. And what I found out was there's this great body of experience that's been sealed up. And when we open it up, it is very complex, interwoven, but there's a few incredibly important factors that come out of it. Number one, the average healthy human being has great difficulty killing anybody. I mean, think about our society. You know, we have 300 million Americans. We have traffic accidents and divorces and marital spats, and the vast, vast, vast majority will go a lifetime and never kill another human being, never try to kill another human being. So on the one hand, it is very difficult for people to kill, but on the other hand, the military has learned how to overcome that resistance through operant conditioning. In World War II, the soldiers shot at bullseye targets on a known distance range. But we learned that that didn't work, that soldiers weren't firing, that we could improve our firing by making it a conditioned response, BF skin or operant conditioning. Anybody who's been in the military or law enforcement, your listeners today, knows they didn't shoot at a bullseye target. A man-shaped silhouette popped up in front of them. That was a conditioned stimulus, conditioned response. You shot the target, you hit the target dropped. Stimulus response, stimulus response. We took this act against which there is such powerful innate resistance. Most healthy members of most societies have a powerful resistance against killing their own kind. And we overcame that resistance, which is a topic of great concern for a lot of people. But the point of it then becomes, if it concerns you that we have turned killing into a conditioned response, and it should, it concerns the military, the law enforcement that I train, how much more so should it concern us that the video games are doing the exact same thing without the safeguards to children? And we can see a powerful link. The school situation today, I teach school safety nationwide, and it is not normal for our SWAT teams to have to train to go in the door and kill our kids. These lockdown drills, this rapid response training that's happened after Columbine, this is not normal. It is not normal to have 500 per 100,000 of your citizens in jail. The incarceration rate per capita is 5 times greater than it has ever been in recorded history. It is not normal for children to commit mass murders in the schools. This is not business as usual. This is something profoundly, frighteningly, staggeringly wrong. And what's happened is we know that the mechanisms that the military uses to train young soldiers to kill is being done to our children without the safeguards of discipline. And we see the horror around the world with juvenile mass murders in the schools and juvenile mass murders in the colleges. I tell people the generation that gave us Jonesboro, the middle school, Columbine in the high school, they're now giving us Virginia Tech in the colleges. And it's going to get worse. We will reap what we sow for generations to come. And so this study, this basically simple question about studying the act of killing, opens up just a wealth of different fields where we hopefully can make a contribution and assist in society's decisions in this process.
Yeah, you know, I'm one of the things that really interests me. It's perhaps understandable that combat veterans, people who had this experience, would not want to talk about it. So to get at the data might be difficult. But I'm still curious about why it is that it seems that before you started doing the work and the research and the writing that led to the book, that nobody, no psychologist, no one working in any of the military academies had in any kind of a disciplined way tried to explore this territory. Why hadn't it been done before?
I'll tell you, David, I'll tell you why I think it's happened. Now, I'm an Army Ranger, infantry company commander. I wanted to go to grad school in the Army's time. And so I applied to teach at West Point. I was accepted by the psychology department. I said, psychology? I don't want no stinking psychology. I'm an Army Ranger. I'm a steely-eyed warrior. I don't want no psychology. But I would have taken a graduate degree in underwater basket weaving. I just kind of wanted to get off the big green machine for a couple of years and get a degree. So I went and got a degree in psychology. And I had the ability to kind of study profiles and personalities. The kind of personality that is in the military would never in a million years become a psychologist in general, as the general personality profiles would outline us. The kind of individuals who would be a psychologist, who would study this area, would never in a million years have been in the military or have focused on developing, if you will, these warrior skills. So the Army took a square peg and pounded it into a round hole. And this is kind of the upshot. I think it was serendipitous, maybe blessed, and this opportunity to study it. And of course, I love this field now. I'm deeply invested in being able to make this contribution. But it is quite rare for those who are in the military to be, if you will, introspective of psychological touchy feely things. Right. And on the other hand, touchy feely psychology people who are willing to study our veterans and. Of course, the other angle is that coming from my background, the veterans felt free to talk, in many cases for the first time in their lives. Early copies of this manuscript, I did hundreds and hundreds of interviews with the veterans community, World War II, and, of course, many, many Vietnam and Korea. And I had early copies of the manuscript floating around the veterans community, copies of copies of copies. And the wife would come to the veteran husband and say, well, is this what it was like for you? And the husband would say, well, let me read that dang book and I'll tell you. And then they would read it. And for the first time, they had this opportunity to discuss this topic. And I kind of make the point up front in the book, I think it's kind of important, that in our society today, killing is a pretty taboo topic. You know, throughout human history, if you wanted a chicken dinner, you had to walk outside, wring the chicken's neck, gut the chicken, pluck the chicken. Throughout history, we were in tune with life and death. I opened the book with a great piece that Garrison Keillor let me use on hog slaughter, about how, you know, every fall they slaughtered the hogs and the smells and the feelings and how that way of life is gone. We no longer have grandma die in the back bedroom. We send them off to some place to die. We no longer take the dead body home and lovingly bathe it and prepare it and bury it out back under the, you know, in our family plot. But all of that death stuff is, we're isolated from it. And it is very much like the way sex was in the Victorian era. I lay kind of a foundation. I think it's valuable. Throughout human history, sex was something kind of noisy and silly that grown-ups did in the middle of the night. Throughout history, we all slept in a common room, a cave, a hut. Throughout history, we all sat around the common fire, and sex was there in front of us all the time, both with animals and with each other. But then in the Victorian era, for the first time in history, the large portion of our society had privacy. And the argument can be made, for the first time in history, we had child abuse. If it had happened before, it would have had to have been with at least the tacit consent of everyone else, because they know what was happening. There was no privacy. But the first time in history, we see child abuse, and we see this obsession with sex, child prostitution and pornography, but at the same time, this Victorian response to sex, in which we put skirts around the sofa legs because they're suggestive, this simultaneous repression and obsession with sex. Well, I think we'd like to think our society has kind of stepped away from that simultaneous repression and obsession with sex. But we've moved head on into the next, if you will, sociological step, which is a simultaneous obsession and repression about violence. Now, the idea of going and slaughtering animals, the idea of the way life was throughout human history is almost repugnant to us to a certain degree, certainly to a large proportion of society. While simultaneously, we obsess with violence in our TV shows, violence in our movies. We consume violence while simultaneously repressing it. And so this book appears to have been accepted as kind of a watershed that allows us to look at ourselves, to take a step back and look at our relationship to violence in society and our world.
Yeah. The book we're talking about, the title is On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society, by our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. It was first published almost 15 years ago and now is out in a revised and updated edition. It's available in paperbacks published by Back Bay, which is a division of Little Brown, so you can seek out the book. Just to introduce again our guest, Dave Grossman is a former Army Ranger, paratrooper, and psychology professor at West Point. Since retiring from the Army in 1998, he's devoted himself to teaching, writing, and training military and law enforcement organizations worldwide about the reality of combat. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You have some really interesting material here in the book about going back and looking at combat, particularly as it was waged in, say, the Napoleonic era, when you had large masses of infantry confronting each other across a field, this big bank of guys with muskets just basically blazing away. And you would think that while even though these weapons were not terribly accurate, that you would end up killing each side would end up killing a lot of the soldiers on the others. And what you look at, if you look at what we can know about how many shots were fired and how many people were hit, that it starts to become very obvious that there were some guys who were, if they were firing, they were deliberately firing over the heads of the other guys. And there apparently is good evidence, and we can see some of this from the Civil War, that there were soldiers who, we're not firing at all. And partly you can see that by when they went out onto the battlefield, they found guns that had been repeatedly loaded over and over again. So that clearly what somebody was doing was they kept ramming, you know, they kept putting in new slugs and never actually pulling trigger.
Yeah.
At what point did the, and this is obviously going to be a problem for the military, you know, you can't have an army that won't shoot the other side.
Yeah.
At what point did the military actually start to say, well, we have to figure out some way that we can get our more of our soldiers being more willing to kill the other side?
Yeah. And there's an enormous resistance, in a way, to being able to talk about this resistance to killing. The data's there. As you said, the Battle of Gettysburg, tens upon tens of thousands of muskets were collected after the battle from off the battlefield. Over half were loaded, and of those, over half had multiple loads in the battlefield. I mean, if we look at the drop muskets as kind of a representation of what was going on in the battlefield, you know, the dying soldier in the midst of battle drops his weapon. What we see is at least a quarter with multiple loads in the barrel. One weapon had 23 loads, you know, shot and powder stuffed down the barrel again and again and again, 23 times. Many, many had dozens and so on. But we have been real reluctant to look at that. What happened was in World War II, Brigadier General S.L.A. Marshall began to actually ask that question, what is happening in combat? And he got the answer that the resistance to killing is very powerful. And so he devised a new mechanism of training that is really the norm now, in which you actually fire at realistic targets. In World War II, we can see that maybe 15 to 20% of the individual riflemen left to their own devices. Now, it's very complex. If there's a leader demanding they fire, it almost always fire. If it was a crew-served weapon or a key weapon, well, people knew if it wasn't firing, it would almost always fire. But the individual rifleman left to their own devices, only maybe 15 to 20% were firing. And at the end of World War II, when our nation was 100%, our armed forces were 100% combat veterans, the great leaders who had taken us through this awful war, they knew that S.L.A. Marshall was right. And they went about a systematic process of overcoming that. By Korea, we got the firing rate up to around 55%. By Vietnam, we got the firing rate up to around 95%. Now, there's still a lot of people spraying and praying, but just to get them to fire appears to have been a significant step forward. Interestingly, there's been a kind of an, from the history world, kind of an academic attack on S.L.A. Marshall, a little side aspect of all of this, claiming that Marshall made all of this up and so on and so forth. And it's really kind of bizarre. We've got lots of data that has, basically we had one historian stand up and say, Marshall didn't do this research. But we've got many others who have related the research. We know the data's there. We know that it happened. This whole business, to me as a psychologist, looking at the field of history, of one man standing up and saying, no, this never happened, and everybody else saying, okay, you're right, and dumping Marshall. You know, the scientific method would say that when we have doubt about our data, we replicate the study. We look at every other study, and every other available piece of data reinforces what Marshall found, this resistance to killing. And furthermore, we've got other studies that have found the very research, the field logs that the researchers said didn't exist. So we validated Marshall, and one of the things that comes out of my book is to have reaffirmed that data. Again, at the end of World War II, when our armed forces were, you know, military veterans universally, they knew it was right. They knew it was true, and they dealt with it. And they made killing this conditioned response. So it really didn't happen until after World War II, and still, in some fields, is a horrendously controversial topic. The data's there. The info's there. It's overwhelming. It's just stunning. And yet, there is a broad section of our society who doesn't want to accept it. And they think of it as maybe stating that our soldiers were cowards. They were not cowards. They were very brave. They would run ammunition. They would reload weapons. They would run messages. Just at the moment of truth, they slammed head on into this resistance. And here's, I think, the nature of this resistance. Inside the mind of most healthy members of most species, it's a powerful resistance against killing their own kind. animals with antlers and horns, they fight one another head-to-head in the most, you know, harmless possible fashion. But against any other species, go to the side, they gut, they gore, they go for the kill. Piranha will sink their teeth in anything that hits the water, except what? Another piranha. Rattlesnakes will sink their fangs in anything and everything, except other rattlesnakes. They wrestle one another. And so when human beings are firing artillery from 2 miles back, it's not hard. When they're dropping bombs from 10,000 feet, it's not hard. But when they're frightened, when the forebrain shuts down and that animal brain takes over, inside the healthy mind of most healthy members of our species, there appears to be this powerful resistance. And I think every one of your listeners can maybe identify with it. Everybody listening, at one time or another, you were red with rage. At one time or another, you were just completely out of control with anger. But at the moment of truth, you didn't kill the person you're angry at. Or if you did, you did a good job of hiding the body, you know? At the moment of truth, no matter how angry, no matter how consumed the anger we were, we didn't go for the eyes. We didn't go for the throat. We didn't grab a steak knife off the table and plunge it in somebody's chest. At the moment of truth, we slam into that resistance. And to me, instead of being offended by this, I think we can be reaffirmed that there is a potential within human beings to move away from violence. Indeed, we can look at military history as an ever-developing mechanism to overcome the resistance, whether it be group dynamics like the phalanx or the machine gun, whether it be leadership dynamics like the Romans with the non-commissioned officers essentially operating immediately behind the line, reinforcing killing behavior, whether it be distance dynamics like the longbow and so on. We can see this phenomenon across history, and it opens up an incredible field of study that gives us a far richer and greater insight into the human condition and the human being in a stressful situation.
Yeah. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that in Effingham on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
A couple of things. The subject matter of this program and the nuance that's being presented is befitting anyone who addresses the subject is to understand patriarchy. I know I've made these statements on this program before, but unless we understand patriarchy and its origins and the killing at the time it began to evolve of female authority and then the horrors that have been produced since then. I'm not talking about 5,000 years ago, but more like 40,000 years ago, or perhaps even 100,000 years that it took males to begin to exercise their superiority of strength and dominance upon the female society. The first that had to happen was females who looked to everything, mother. To kill one's mother, you know, was not part of the paradigm of human existence. And to overwhelm that took a very long time. But that's what had to happen.
Sure. Dave, you know, it's a great example. Our caller brings up a really interesting question, which to me, the root of the question is male violence versus female violence. And are males more inclined to kill? Are we dealing with testosterone poisoning? Are we dealing with conditioning? And what I would tell you is that this is that fundamental question being raised by the caller here, and a profoundly important question. When we study the act of killing, when we study cops who are killed, and I have interviewed literally thousands of cops who've killed. I've been on the road almost 300 days a year, going on 12 years now, training military and law enforcement. My website, killology.com, you can look at the speaking schedule. I train all of our feds, all of our spec ops, all of our military, and every state in the nation. When we look around the world at the ability of women to kill, we find that there's just not much difference. That faced with the same degree of training, given the same weapons, our female soldiers, our female cops, are responding almost precisely the same as their males' equivalent. We need a lot more data on this info. The number of females who have killed in law enforcement and military is still fairly small. But I actively seek out this this data, and what I'm seeing is no significant difference. So there might be validity to what the caller's talking about here, indeed. I mean, it's kind of outside of my realm as far as, you know, 40,000 years ago, patriarchy versus matriarchy, and there may be some validity there. But the area where my research would take that is to try to study the difference between male and female responses to combat. And I said, you know, the dubious honors of the battlefield, women have demonstrated themselves to be every bit as capable killers as men when placed in that situation where we need to do it. Now, are they doing it more as a protector? Because my female cops who are killing it, very interesting. They respond a slightly different manner in which they're more aware of the whole environment. They have a greater degree of situational awareness. There's kind of like two responses that I find when somebody kills. One is what I call the charging lion. The charging lion gets tunnel vision. He's a heat-seeking missile. He locks onto his prey. But there's the other that I call the wolf pack response. And the wolf pack, they're aware of everybody else that's around them, and they're acting as a team, and they've got this greater sense of situational awareness. Again, I don't have the data to make definitive statements, but consistently, I keep seeing my females, when they're in a killing situation, to respond more in this wolf pack response, this knowledge of everything around, and maybe there is a genetic predisposition to protection. But I think it's a pretty minor aspect. Otherwise, we would have identified it over these times as we see more and more women. I tell people, you know, it's not about the hardware in your hand or the hardware between your legs. It's about the software in your head and in your heart. It's about the training and the mental preparation. So this is just a fascinating topic. And the research that I would have would apply to this question to a certain degree, that there is no significant difference between males and females when it comes to the act of killing.
Well, I want to thank the caller. I got somebody else I want to get on to, and we are just a little bit past our midpoint here on Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and the guest is Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. He's a former Army Ranger, paratrooper, psychology professor at West Point, and since he retired from the Army in 1998, he's spent a lot of time teaching, writing, and training both military and law enforcement organizations around the world about the reality of combat. And if you're interested in reading on this subject, you should look at the book that we've mentioned here a couple of times, a book that he first published now almost 15 years ago. The title is On Killing. The subtitle is The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society. It has now been published in a revised and updated edition. It's published in paperback. Back Bay is the publisher. It's a division of Little Brown. So if you'd like to read on this subject, you can go out to the bookstore or to the library and find the book. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. On to another caller here, Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. I missed part of your discussion, so forgive me if this is a repeat. But I'm wondering about the parallel between the conditioning that soldiers are asked to do and the repeated violence that we see in television and how it affects our children.
Oh, absolutely. Well said. And we did mention that earlier, but it deserves to be mentioned again because it is the culminating point of this research. If we're concerned how operant conditioning and classical conditioning and social learning models have been manipulated over years to enable soldiers to kill, and we should be concerned. It's a topic that we've got to look at with great caution that our military does. How much more so should we be concerned? That same thing is being done indiscriminately to our children. The FBI consultant, Dr. Jim McGee, who did the definitive study of 19 juvenile mass murders in the schools. Now, juvenile mass murders in the schools have never happened before in history. The all-time record juvenile mass murder in history was Jonesboro, a couple of middle schoolers. It was completely eclipsed a year later by Columbine, which in turn has been completely eclipsed recently by Virginia Tech. But the all-time record juvenile mass murder in human history, juvenile mass murders in the schools have never happened in history. I can find one 30 years ago, just a couple dead in the school. I can find one 25 years ago, a couple dead in the school. But starting 11 years ago with Jonesboro and then Columbine 10 years ago, there has been an explosion of juvenile mass murders. So we have this definitive study of 19 juvenile mass murders. And every single one of them had one thing in common. they had dropped out of life. They refused to participate in any structured disciplined adult-led behavior, sports, martial arts, paintball, hunting, Boy Scouts, Junior ROTC, student body government. They had rejected all structured disciplined adult-led behavior. Now, they spent every free moment of every day immersed in a culture of violence, television, movie, and video games. In July 2000, a joint statement was made before both houses of Congress. Now, in July 2000 in Washington, D.C., a joint statement by the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Now, this is all of our doctors, all of our pediatricians, all of our psychologists, all of our child psychiatrists telling both houses of Congress. 1,000 sound scholarly studies and 30 years of research have proven that media violence causes violence in our society. And they went on to say that the violent video games are particularly dangerous because of their, quote, interactive nature. So my work comes at this whole idea of media violence and enabling people to kill from a different angle. And it's pretty profound. And we've been able to make a contribution to the field from that direction to understand this resistance and how it can be turned off by kids. And again, just intuitively, you leap to the most important point, the final section of the book, which is an understanding of violence in our society. And I say it again, it is not normal for cops to practice going into school and shooting our kids. It is not normal to do lockdown drills. We got to do it. But it is not normal to have a 500 out of 100,000 of your population in jail, five times more per capita than ever in the history of our nation. This is not normal. This is not business as usual. This is a frightening, unprecedented phenomenon in human history. And we have been put our finger on the new ingredient. All the old problems are still there. The old problems are still important. But the new ingredient is this violent visual imagery marketed to kids, which is giving us, in spite of everything we do, and we've done enormous efforts to keep our kids safe. We put tens of thousands of cops in a school. And once a cop's in the school, if you have an armed cop in your school, the probability of a multiple homicide goes down to virtually zero. The kid just doesn't even try. They just don't even try. We've essentially inoculated tens of thousands of schools by putting an armed cop in the school. We no longer are going to sit on the perimeter for an hour like Columbine and let this guy rampage through our school. We're going in like thunder, and we're stopping these kids before they get the big body count. We deter them by the thousands every year. We detect them. We're catching these kids. When I have my audiences, I say every teacher in the classroom, every educator, every cop, every social worker in this classroom, I'll bet you know one or two cases where we caught the kid with a gun, we caught him with a hit list, we caught him with a bomb, and it never got in the news. And every person in the audience nods their heads. I say, if you know one or two cases where we caught the kid before they commit the crime, how many are there nationwide? I tell you, every year we deter these kids by the thousands. We detect them. We catch them before they commit their acts by the hundreds. And we go in the door in a couple places across America, and we shoot our kids before they can get the body count. Most of us never heard of Spokane, Washington, because the cops are in the door of that high school and 5 minutes flat and put a rifle slug in the kid. The first one, he survived. Nobody died that day. Barely made the national news, just a little blip on the news. First words out of the kid's mouth, how'd you get here so fast? You don't hear about these things. And yet still, we deter them by the thousands. We detect them by the hundreds. We go in the door and shoot them before they get the body count. And yet still, every couple of years, we have a new all-time record body count. The year Columbine happened, there were 32 dead in our schools from violence. In 2004, we had 48 dead in the schools. Every couple of years, we get a new all-time record dead. And this is not normal. This is not business as usual. And every citizen, every parent asks themselves, what is the new factor in the equation? Poverty and gangs and drugs and access to weapons, lead poisoning, these are all vital ingredients. But the new ingredient is this violent visual imagery. And here's the good news. To me, this is just incredibly refreshing and good news. Stanford University Med School pioneered a TV turn-off curriculum. It's called the SMART curriculum. And the crazy part is when we tell the kids to turn it off, they do. And in controlled double-blind studies, entire school districts are putting this in place now. Turn off TV, movie, and video games. Everywhere it goes in, we cut violence in half, as measured by controlled double-blind study of of playground and cafeteria behavior. We cut violence in half. We cut bullying in half. Oh, by the way, it's the single most powerful juvenile obesity reduction program ever demonstrated. And everywhere it goes in, we raise test scores double digits. Violence cut in half, bullying cut in half, obesity reduced, and test scores go up double digits everywhere we do it. There has been 30 years of research that tells us the more television a kid watches, the worse his grades. And nationwide, what we're doing is we're turning off the television and the grades improve. Duh. So this TV turn-off curriculum, the situation has gotten so bad that when we finally turn it off, the benefits are so astounding that nobody can deny it. And around the world, this curriculum is going in, and everywhere it goes in, we're turning the tide. I tell people, you know, a teacher can't fix a broken society. A teacher can't even fix a broken kid. On a good day, all a teacher can do is teach. But in the end, education is the only true transformational tool any society has ever had. When we educate our kids about this and we teach them to turn it off, we are going to turn the tide and move back to where we ought to be, away from this dark and tragic time. I'm truly optimistic, and I'm leading the charge. This TV turn-off, this whole toxic aspect to our society, and it's all laid out again, and all the foundation established again in the book on killing. And your caller just intuitively jumped right to the heart of the matter.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Appreciate your efforts.
I've got some other callers here, and I want to get to them. It's pretty hard to argue with a lot of the ideas that you've laid out. I'm sure at the same time, though, some people would say, well, you know, there are a lot of people, adults and children, who play video games, and some of them are violent, and we watch violent movies, but not everyone becomes a killer. Yeah. There has to be something else going on.
Absolutely. And the analogy really is like heart disease. Now, I tell people, don't get trapped in a simplistic single-cause model. Doctor, what causes heart disease? Obesity, high cholesterol diet, genetics, stress, lack of exercise. These are all factors in heart disease. Now, if you add tobacco, you double, maybe triple your risk of heart disease. Has there always been heart disease? Well, there'll always be heart disease, yeah. You add this one new factor, you double, maybe triple your risk. And if you quit smoking, you cut your risk in half right now. Mm-hmm. Now, in the same way, doctor, what causes violence? No simplistic single-cause models allowed. Yeah? I blame the parents. Oh, it's the guns. No, it's everything. Poverty, gangs, drugs, access to weapons, breakdown of the social structure, lead poisoning, mental illness. These are all factors in violence. Take the existing factors anywhere in the world, add one new factor. You double, maybe triple your risk of violence. Has there always been violence? Will there always be violence? But you add this one new factor, you double, maybe triple your risk. And if we take this one factor out, boom, we cut our risk in half. Not everybody that smokes is going to die from smoking, but a large portion of our heart disease is because of smoking. Not everybody who watches violent media, and by the way, it's okay for adults. The data is clear. Adults can handle it. It's children, and especially very young children, that are having the most profound impact. Not every kid who's exposed and traumatized by violent visual imagery kills, but all of the killers have one thing in common. They have immersed themselves in this culture of violence, this new breed of killers. Most of them just will become obese. Most of them, these kids who are immersed in this environment, they will become fearful. They may become bullies. Most of the kids immersed in this violence will just get worse grades. But some of them will become killers. And this is the new ingredient in this society. And we have a whole host of things we say adults can do but kids can't. Firearms and automobiles and tobacco and alcohol and pornography and sex and drugs. There's a whole host of things adults can do but kids can't. What we're finding out is violent visual imagery is on that list. Now, the written word is completely different. Your dog will never read, your dog will never speak, but your dog can process violent visual imagery. Violent visual imagery is processed completely differently in the brain. By the way, I had a paper in Pediatrics Annals. I was a presenter at the American Academy of Pediatrics. And this impact of media violence on young children, their mantra, this one pediatrician said, Dave, I got a great example. He says, a three-year-old is brought into my pediatrics office because he's been kicked out of daycare for uncontrolled violence. The kid's building a rap sheet at age three. The parents say, Doc, we give up. Medicate our kids. Doc says, before we medicate a three-year-old, let's try something. No television, no movie, no video games, 1 week. That before we put the kid on any drug, take him off the current drug. No television, no movie, no video games, 1 week. 1 week later, there's a testimonial from the daycare center, readmitted the child, transformed child, problem gone. Testimonial from the parents who now understand, and before we put the kid on any drug, take him off the current drug, and the current drug is television, the movies, the video games. And what we're really learning is the harm that can be done at the young age and the necessity to protect the kids. It's very similar to the whole lead poisoning dynamic that happened and that we fought our way through with the lead industry, and we finally were able to accept the fact. These are things we have to protect our children from, and it's coming. And I really see the door being opened to a pretty neat place down the road. But in the meanwhile, we got a couple of hard years in front of us.
Yeah.
The kids that gave us Jonesboro and Columbine are now giving us Virginia Tech. Yeah.
Let's talk with some other callers. We'll go to Champaign County here next for a caller here, line two. Hello.
Hi. I think there's something to be said for the violent imagery and the desensitization, but I think the reality of the violent society that we live in, with soldiers coming back and killing spouses and selves, the desensitization of someone you actually know being killed seems to be much more important, I would think, than the, just the simple visual.
Sure. Two important
imagery.
Aspects of this. You really nailed two important aspects. Number one is that, you know, when we look at these massacres in the school, when we look at the killings in the school, when we look at this horrendous increase in bullying and violence, every one of those incidents creates a network, a nexus of individuals who are terribly traumatized. When we talk about Columbine, we might talk about the number dead. When we talk about Virginia Tech, we might talk about the number dead. But how many friends, how many family, how many classmates, how many associates? There's just second and third order effects that ripple down across the generations from every violent act. But a second angle on this is really pretty important. We talk about the returning soldiers. Now, 3 million Americans have been in the war zone over the last 7 years. The data is clear. They come back, and they're like the World War II veterans. They are, by every measure, less likely to commit homicides, less likely to commit murders. We had a cluster of three spousal homicides in Fort Bragg 6 years ago, and to my knowledge, that's the only one. We had one brigade that came home in Fort Carson, and a couple of soldiers committed a couple of homicides. But the homicide rate, the violence rate, the spouse abuse rate among our soldiers is considerably less than among the general population of the same age and the same sex. Now, any day now, of the millions and millions of soldiers in the war zone, any day now, one of them is going to come home and commit some multiple homicide. One of them is going to go postal. It's going to happen. But the amazing thing is it hasn't happened yet. When it happens, the media will be all over it. Crazed soldier comes home, commits mass murder. We got to worry about all the soldiers. But the truth is just the opposite.
I if I might interject, as you interjected on me, I don't buy it. We have examples around here of incidents, and the media doesn't actually emphasize the fact that this person who murdered this person in the rural area was actually a returned National Guard person who had been PTSD. So I question your statistics entirely.
Yeah, statistically speaking, the data is clear. And no Virginia Tech, no...
Are you including the National Guard?
Yes, indeed, indeed. And the data is clear. The returning veteran... Now, they do have some problems we got to deal with. The vast, vast majority, around 85%, come home, and they're just fine. About 15% has a little bit of baggage, and we can deal with it. We are vastly better at treating PTSD than we've ever been before. Does that mean that none of them will come home and commit these acts? No. Does that mean that violence is good? No. But we've got to realistically address the magnitude of the threat, and I think it is appropriate to be concerned about this. You are quite right. This is a topic of concern. If they were to come home and use their skills against us, how tragic, how horrific it would be. But the safeguards, to a certain degree, are in place. How much more so are we got to worry about the kids that gave us Jonesboro, Columbine, Pearl, Paducah, Springfield, Littleton, Edinburgh, Santee, San Diego, Moses Lake? How much do we have to worry about the generation that grew up and gave us Virginia Tech and Northern Illinois University and Louisiana Tech? Again, we cannot find one single returning veteran committing these mass murders. The mass murders are being done by children in our schools.
Again,
and by college students in our colleges. Find me a returning veteran that gave us a Virginia Tech or Northern Illinois University. The data is just not there. It is a topic of concern. But how much more so should we, must we be concerned that the same thing is being done indiscriminately to our children as they are confronted with violent visual imagery?
If I might.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
So you're saying that soldiers don't come and do mass murders, but the violence that the statistics that I've heard about returning veterans is extremely high, and they are very traumatized. The fact that they don't do a mass murder, I think mass murders are very spectacular, but there are more people killed by a single murderer.
Go to my website. Go to my website.
I'm just saying the overall...
Killology.com, and on posted on my website, I will have the data on the veterans. And the violence rate and the fact that, you know, again, it's a topic of concern. Every warrior society has to face the same dilemma. That Alexander the Great, the Romans, the British Empire, the kids who came home from the Civil War, World War One, World War Two. What is to stop the returning veteran from using their skills on their own society? It is a profound, basic, fundamental psychological fear, of sociological fear of every society. And every warrior society has found the same safeguard, discipline.
We just have a couple of minutes left. Forgive me for jumping in here, and I appreciate the comments of the caller. I guess my feeling, my impression is that it is maybe more likely that a returning veteran might be a threat to himself or herself. Maybe more than other people around them. And I don't mean to suggest that people haven't been violent with family members or whatever. I guess for me, my bottom line is we know just how stressful combat experience can be. We put people through things so that they'll do the job and then put them in this incredibly stressful environment. It just strikes me that we have, in some sense, though, we failed in trying to, when people come home, do some kind of assessment to see how they're doing, and then provide care to people who need it. It seems that we've really failed.
We need to do it more. We need to spend more money on our veterans. We need to invest more resources. The Veterans Administration is doing a wonderful job, but we can always do more. And you have identified it completely. Your caller has identified it. It's a topic for concern. But think about the survivors on the battlefield in Virginia Tech. Think about the survivors who walked away from the horrors of Northern Illinois University. Think about all of the violence. Again, your caller calls in and talks about the onesies and twosies out in the countryside that never hits the national news. But every one of those deaths has a nexus of interactive, horribly toxic dynamics. The family members and the neighbors and the people who went to school, these people who see violence before their eyes when they see horrible events, it erodes at the very fabric of our civilization. So I think the fundamental point we can all agree on is violence anywhere. Violence anywhere, whether it's in our military or in our schools, is a toxic, horrendous event. And we've got to emphasize that. And that's the point of the book. But simultaneously, we've got to understand that the safeguards being done with our soldiers, it's being done to adults. They're prepared for this violence. They're psychologically prepared to meet this violence. How much more so? How much more so is it destroying the children who are in the school where this violence happened, in Jonesboro, Pearl, Paducah, Springfield? Again, these legitimate concerns about our soldiers. But when we look at our children who are growing up in a war zone in the inner cities, our children whose classroom has been a site of a mass murder, and we hear the numbers, we read the research, and we don't even begin to think of the second and third order effects. So these are all terribly important points, and we try in the book on killing to address them across the board. But we culminated in this application of the knowledge, as you one caller came in, to this kind of intuitive understanding of how much more so is it happening to our children, how much more so must we protect them from these violent visual images and from violence in our society.
Let's try real quick to get one more caller. We'll go to Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello. Quick, obvious question. Yeah. Once someone has killed, is it psychologically easier to do it a second time?
Oh, well said. Another fundamental question, and the answer is yes. Now, when it's our cops and when it's our military, if they've had to kill, the first one can be very traumatic. Many people vomit after the first kill, and not all, certainly by any large proportion, but the first one's rather traumatic. Some people are completely untroubled, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with them. But almost everybody, it's easier the second time. You have reached a degree of kind of getting over the hump of psychologically embracing the reality. So I know as a fact, where there's a cop in the street or a veteran in the military unit, those who have seen the elephant, those who have been in combat, those who have had to use deadly force, are now veterans. They're better prepared, better enabled, better equipped. But the same thing can also be said for those who commit murders in our society. You know, and so we can take that also and transfer that info. But you're quite right. There can be no doubt. These people are veterans, in the cops and the military. But what does it say about our inner city? And by the way, when we talk about violence in inner city, one real interesting side point, medical technology is holding down the murder rate. The murder rate is being held down by medical technology. If we had 1970s technology, the murder rate would be four times what it is. If we had 1930s technology, the murder rate would be 10 times what it is.
You mean because people are surviving the...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the survivors are carrying the trauma with them. The docs are saving ever more lives.
Yeah.
But those lives are touched and marred by violence.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry that we're at the end, and I have a couple of callers we're not going to be able to take. My apologies, but certainly if people would like to read more on the subject, the book to look at is the one we mentioned a couple of times by our guest. Again, the title is On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society, published by Back Bay, by our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. He's a former Army Ranger, paratrooper, and psychology professor at West Point, and has done a lot of writing on the subject of military and law enforcement and the experience of having to kill on the line of duty. Colonel Grossman, thanks very much for talking
with us. My pleasure. You're very welcome, and I'm honored to be in the service. Take care. Bye.